So Bernardine, I was hoping you could start with reading the manifesto. I would love to hear it in your own words.
Certainly. There is a manifesto in each one of us, emerging over the course of our lives, changing and reconfiguring through our experiences. This is mine.
For Bernardine Evaristo, the personal is always political. In 2019, she became the first Black woman to win the Booker Prize for her novel Girl, Woman, Other. And since then, she has been tireless in using that fame to support other artists and writers of color, in particular by publishing undiscovered Black British writers who might otherwise never be known. Her new memoir is called Manifesto, on Never Giving Up. So that's where Shannon Henry Kleiber asked her to begin.
Be wild, disobedient, and daring with your creativity. Take risks instead of following predictable routes. Those who play it safe do not advance our culture or civilization. A wise person chooses partners who will support their creativity and gets rid of those who will undermine, sabotage, or even destroy it. Personal success is most meaningful when used to uplift communities otherwise left behind. We are all interconnected and must look after each other. Society operates via powerful and often impenetrable networks that uphold its tribal hierarchies. So we must establish our own systems as countermeasure. We must pass on what we know to the next generation and express gratitude to those who help us. Nobody gets anywhere on their own. The ancestors are swaying silently behind us. The dead souls of the once dearly departed, who are the reason why we came into being, we must remember them.
I love your confidence in your memoir and your life, and I was just struck by how so many artists second-guess themselves and just take rejection and sock it away. And I just loved your joyful tenacity. Where does that come from?
Yeah, because the subtitle of the book is On Never Giving Up. I think it has multiple sources, really, that tenacity. I was born into a tenacious family. I come from a mixed marriage. My father was Nigerian, my mother English, and they married in the 1950s in the face of huge social and family disapproval, especially on my mother's side of the family. And yet they loved each other and that was it. So they were going to get married and they did, and they had 8 children in 10 years. And so my mother's mother really objected to the marriage between my parents, but she also objected to the number of children that my parents had. So they were people who followed their hearts and led the life that they wanted to lead. And that was also the story of my childhood, that my parents had married in spite of the pressures against them. And perhaps that then is the source of my own tenacity.
In your childhood, you write about this period of time where bricks were being thrown through your window on a regular basis, and your father kept a hammer on the side of his bed. And I just think that must have been so frightening. Can you tell me about how you felt at that time? How old were you when that was happening?
It was happening in the 60s. Obviously, it was a very long time ago, but it is something that definitely marked my childhood. It made me feel that I was not accepted in the community in which I grew up. It was a very white area that I grew up in. Britain was much whiter than it is now, but also the area I grew up in was a particularly white area. It didn't make me feel that I belonged, and it made me feel that people were hostile towards me. And I think when you're a little child, that's very disturbing and very sad, because you're just a child, you're innocent, you haven't done anything. And yet people are expressing this violent anger about your very existence.
And your parents became activists. Did that influence you in your activism?
I think, yes, definitely. They were left-wing socialist and very active in the trade unions where they worked. My father was a local political figure in the area I grew up in, the borough of Greenwich. Political conversations were had around our table when we had meals and so on. And also, as I said, I think when you're growing up in a racist society and you're a person of colour, I think you do have a choice as to whether you're going to be somebody who fights against that or whether you're going to be somebody who just gets on with your life and tries to keep your head above water and but not put your head above the parapet. And my parents were people who put their heads above the parapet. And as soon as I was able to, when I went to drama school, which was a very political drama school, I too did that. You know, I became somebody who was prepared to stand up for what I believed in, which at that time was around race and feminism.
And what you were doing in the theater was activism. The stories are so interesting about how there were no roles for Black women. And instead of giving up, you created them. You created a theater company. You created the roles. You made it happen.
That's right. And at a time when nobody was interested in us as Black women, you know, we were in our early 20s. We were theater school, drama school graduates. We realized there was no work for us out there. And so it made absolute sense for us to create our own theatre company, and we called it Theatre of Black Women. We were forging a theatrical identity for ourselves in a very racist society. I was quite a hothead. Myself and my friend Patricia, who was one of the co-founders of Theatre Company, we used to go to theatre a lot. And as I said, the theatre was very white. And when it wasn't white, it was very male. And so if we objected to something on political grounds, we would heckle very loudly and disrupt shows, basically. And we would position ourselves at the back of the theatre so that we could make an easy escape. You know, I grew out of that quite quickly. But when I do think about it, I am slightly outraged because I would never do that now. But if we found something offensive on political grounds, that was all we had at our disposal. You must remember, especially for younger audiences, that there was no social media, there was no Twitter, there was no internet, you know. We had our voices and that was it.
Your novel, Girl, Woman, Other, is so innovative in form and art and punctuation and groundbreaking in so many ways. It's 12 characters, 11 women and one non-binary character. How do you describe the book?
I call it a fusion fiction in terms of the form of it because it fuses different stories together, and also the way I've used the language on the page. It is a book that is, in a way, an ode to Black British women. And it's a book that travels over well over 100 years. So that it's like a tapestry.
And then it won the Booker Prize in 2019, which is the pinnacle, of course, and something you'd hoped for, as you write in your memoir, but it's hard to say it out loud, but something that you had actually really said out loud to yourself, at least. You have said it wasn't an overnight success, obviously, but that everything changed overnight. So what changed?
Everything. So
yeah.
Girl, Woman, Other has sold well over a million copies in the English language alone. And compared to the sales of my previous books that were often critical successes, but they simply did not sell beyond a few thousand, the reach of my work has just exploded. And then how everybody saw me changed. The image of me as a writer literally changed overnight. And suddenly I was considered a heavyweight. And it's not that anybody thought I was a lightweight before, but I was often not included in the way that I wanted to be in terms of the literary culture here. And also I have a huge platform now that I didn't have before as an activist.
Well, there's a long tradition of political writers from Aristotle to Ray Bradbury to Margaret Atwood, and their work is a form of activism and social conscience, and it's a part of history. How do you see your place in this part of ongoing history?
Yeah, I'm very aware that as I'm one of the very few Black British women novelists out there, I am writing our stories into history. I am redressing our absence the absence of our stories in literature in Britain. And if it's not going to be in Britain, it's not going to be anywhere else either. So I'm very aware that I'm making history in the sense, not in the egotistical sense of, you know, I'm so famous, I'm going to make history, but that I am rewriting history and reimagining history through my work, but also as a writer doing what I do, I am also counteracting invisibility.
Do you remember the first time you thought of writing as a political act?
Probably the first poem I ever wrote was about the suffragettes. It was in a school magazine. I lost the school magazine. I went back to my old school last year and they dug it out of the archives and gave me a copy. And it was just wonderful to see it. And I thought, my God, Bernadine, you thought you became a feminist when you went to drama school, but this is such a feminist poem. Back then when I was 14.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is being a political writer different now than being one in previous generations?
The first thing to say is that all writing is political. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously somebody like Margaret Atwood, you know, grapples with the really big issues of the day and imagines our society in ways that are, you know, really dystopian, for example, with The Handmaid's Tale and Testaments. All writing is political. I think, no, when I go back to the writers who inspired me when I was a young woman, when I go back to Toni Morrison, Alice Walker, Michelle Clift, Audre Lorde, they were very political writers in America and writing Black women's stories into being. That's what they were doing. And they were the first generation to do that in great numbers, actually, anywhere in the world, anywhere in the world.
I'd love to have our listeners learn about your Black Britain writing project. So these are writers who have been overlooked, forgotten, maybe never even known, and you're bringing them back to print. So the publishing business is a very complex and difficult business for many people, but what you're doing with this is really introducing a whole new canon of underrepresented writers into the public. I mean, it's really not an exaggeration to say some of these writers, maybe all of them, would be unknown without this project, and you're giving them a voice and you're giving them a life. Can you tell us a little bit about some of them? Who are you proudest of bringing back into print?
Yeah, so the project's called Black Britain Writing Back, and the idea is to bring back writers that were overlooked or have disappeared from view, going back over 100 years, actually. I think the two books that are sort of standout books in some ways are Growing Out, Black Hair and Black Pride in 60s Britain by somebody called Barbara Blake Hanna, which is an absolutely fantastic memoir about her time living in London in the 1960s. There's also A Black Boy at Eton by Dilibi Onyema, who was the first African, no, take it back, the first Black person to graduate from Eton College, which is the most elite school in this country. It's about 1,300 years old, and I think is probably the most famous school in the world. And he was a student there in the 60s. A couple of years after he left, he wrote a memoir about his time there. It was published in 1972, and it is brilliantly written, but also really shocking in terms of the racism he experienced at this super elite school. The headmaster of Eton banished him from ever darkening their doors again, and the book was kind of trashed by the media. Eventually, he went back to Nigeria, and we've now brought the book back. What I find so interesting about Dilibi's book is that Eton College has produced 20 British prime ministers, including our current one. So it is really the seat of the establishment in this country. It is the hothouse of the elite in this country. And when you read about his treatment as a Nigerian boy at that school at that time, it really makes you reflect seriously on the nature of the people who then went on to run this country in all the kind of most important fields, you know, in the last sort of 50 years or so, because they were the boys he was at school with.
How do you keep going? I mean, you say you're stubborn, and it totally comes through in your memoir that you are not going to give up, but you're experiencing throughout your life racism and ageism and misogyny. Is that what keeps you going, or what keeps you going?
actually, what keeps me going is that I love what I do. That's a really good incentive, isn't it? I love creativity. I've led a creative life all my life. I love writing. Sometimes it's frustrating and a bit struggling and it might not work out for a while, but essentially I love it. I don't know how I would function if I didn't have creative self-expression in my life through my writing and creating other worlds and other stories, you know, because I'm not writing about myself, most of all. I'm writing about these other imagined lives. I live in my imagination and it's a wonderful place to be. It's very liberating and exciting and adventurous. And yeah, so that's what keeps me going. Yes, there are always obstacles and definitely obstacles in my past. But if you're doing what you love and also enjoying the result of what you do, so I do enjoy my books. You know, when I finish my books, I don't always think they're great, but when I finish my books, there is such a degree of satisfaction that they are what they are. And I hope they do well out there in the world. But I know I've put everything into them. And it's exciting. Being a writer for me is so exciting. It's a gorgeous job. So that, you know, that keeps me going.
That was Shannon Henry Kleiber talking with Bernardine Evaristo about her new memoir, Manifesto, on Never Giving Up.